Right, so this is something a little bit different. Basically, as some of you know, I'm writing a book at the moment about my reporting on the YDGH, the PKK Urban Youth Group, the militant group. Now, you know, most of them are wiped out. They're kind of almost all dead. And then they turned into another group called YPS, which was like a merger of the youth versus the urban guerrilla. But anyway, so the YDGH, you know, the reason I was arrested in Turkey, the reason I even started reporting on Kurdish issue was because of the YDGH, this fascinating militant youth group in the cities of Turkey that weren't going to the mountains. They were starting their own wars. So I started doing that. I've been writing this book. It's going to be out maybe next year, maybe the end of this year. It's just Corona has messed everything up. But I was thinking that when I do actually put it out, I want to do like maybe some previews of what is in the book. And I was having a little practice around and I thought, you know what, let me put this out as you know, on the Patreon. So this is basically an idea, a very rough like draft idea of what I might launch. Won't launch, but like what I might just put out when my book does finally come out. It's going to be called Autonomous Zone. And yeah, so this is just the prologue from the book. I've added some like noise in here and there, but it's actually the genuine noise from the thing I'm talking about in the book. You'll hear it because obviously we were filming at the time, so this is actually the same words that were being spoken, same sounds. So yeah, you'll hear all that. So yeah, let's see what it's like. The first time I met the YDGH, they were rioting on the streets of Turkey, throwing petrol bombs with makeshift balaclavas pulled over their heads.
PKK?
Yedigash.
Yedigash. Young.
This was in Istanbul, some 900 miles away from the historic boundaries of North Kurdistan. It was summer 2014. ISIS was spreading like wildfire across Iraq and Syria. The jihadists had reached Turkey's border in the south of the country as they attacked the Kurdish city of Kobani in northern Syria. In Kobani, civilians young and old were murdered in the streets. Their homes were raided and torched. Vehicles were converted into bombs. Corpses lay strewn amongst the rubble. ISIS had come to raise their black flag and were massacring anyone in their way. Across the border in southeast Turkey, the vast majority of residents are actually Kurdish. Roughly 10 million Kurds live in the southeast. From their own front gardens, they could see black smoke rising over Kobani as ISIS tried to raise the city. Shelling and gunfire rang out all night as local militias in Kobani attempted to fight back. As the clashes raged on, the Turkish military watched on passively from the border. They did nothing. Kurds in Turkey mobilized themselves and tried to cross to assist in the battle, but Turkish soldiers denied them. It began to look as if the Turkish government was happy to have ISIS as their neighbor, so long as it meant that they wiped out the Kurds who were there before them. The Kurds of southeast Turkey were enraged. Meanwhile, PKK militants grabbed their weapons and swarmed to Kobani from their base in the nearby Kandil Mountains of Iraq. For the first time in decades, they weren't fighting Turkey, but a new enemy, ISIS. On September 27, 2014, the US began hitting ISIS with airstrikes across Kobani. All day long, US warplanes could be seen showering bombs over the city. In October, they conducted 39 airstrikes in just 2 days. This section of the Turkish border became a campout for journalists from all over the world. As the spectacle of airstrikes and distant tracer rounds continued in northeast Syria, angry protests began to break out all across Turkey. The Kurds grew increasingly furious that the Turkish government, who at that time was trying to normalize relations with their Kurdish brothers, wouldn't let them defend their own people in Kobani. The rowdy but often non-violent protests were met with police water cannon and tear gas. This is when the YDGH first began to make noise. In response, they mobilized into an urban youth group of rage, forming franchises in dozens of cities across Turkey. They'd shout Tahildan and Sahildan, Kurdish for revenge and uprising, as they lobbed rocks and fired pistols at the police. They formed strategies for clashing in the streets against security forces and shared them via WhatsApp with YDGH cells in other cities. Soon the tactics spread throughout the whole of Turkey. At this time in 2014, the YDGH was almost unheard of outside of the Kurdish community and the Turkish press. I'd been told about them through a friend of a friend. I was interested. Most of the world's conflict journalists were headed out to the Syrian border to watch the airstrikes. I didn't want to do that. That area was already saturated. People were joking that there were more reporters on the border than refugees. Instead, I wanted to cover the YDGH clashes in the cities. Back then, I was working for Vice News. This is when it was in its infancy, before the HBO money came in and ruined everything. It was amazing back then. Things were very raw and makeshift. You didn't have to sit about in pitch meetings for hours to get your ideas heard. You could just corner your editor and have a word. If you had a good idea, you'd be on a plane within days. I was able to convince my boss that I could get decent enough access to the YDGH in Istanbul. We'd make a news documentary about why they were clashing in the streets with Turkish police instead of heading off to Kobani to fight ISIS. The boss man liked it. I was teamed up with my close friend and cameraman Phil Pendlebury. Within a week, we were in Istanbul. It was my first time in Turkey. I was 24 years old and had only been working properly as a conflict journalist for 6 months. Being in Istanbul was incredible. We based ourselves just outside of Okmaydan, a rundown neighbourhood in the centre of the city where the most violent clashes were taking place. Okmaydan sits on the west side of Istanbul, around a 40-minute drive from the Bosphorus Strait. The strait splits the city into two halves, the European side and the Asian side. Residents of Okmaydan are mostly a mix of Kurds and Turks. Their ideologies vary, as can be seen by the graffiti dedicated to different leftist groups sprayed over every wall in the neighbourhood. There were maybe a dozen different armed political street groups operating in Okmaydan at the time. YDGH, Dev Gench, DHKPC, MLKP, TKO to name a few. They tolerated one another, but long-running disputes between the various revolutionary factions were constant. It wasn't unheard of for gun battles to break out between feuding groups. The only thing the whole of Okmaydan seemed to agree on was that they absolutely did not like President Erdogan. Within about 15 minutes of entering Okmaydan, a young lad of about 13 years old ran up to me and shouted, "Erdogan Katil," which means Erdogan is a murderer.
Erdogan Katil!
After a few days dipping in and out of the neighbourhood, speaking to the locals about YDGH, I was invited to attend a public funeral march in Okmaydan. A young Turkish man from the area had been killed in Kobani. His name was Sufi Nejat Aganazli. He died 2 weeks earlier whilst fighting ISIS. Aganazli was a devoted Marxist and anti-fascist. He saw the Kurdish struggle in Rojava as one aligned with his own leftist beliefs, so travelled out to fight alongside the Kurdish YPG militia. In a letter written to his parents before he left, he said it was his duty to help defend Kobani. Whilst in battle, Aganazli was shot first in the stomach and then in the spine as his friend tried to drag him to safety. Two rounds from an M16 tore through his kidney and shattered his vertebrae. Nothing could be done to save his life. He was just 29 years old. Phil and me headed down to film the funeral procession in Okmaydan. Young men and women had gathered on the streets to commemorate Aganazli's death. They carried a long banner with his smiling face on it as they moved through the winding alleyways of the neighbourhood. Loud Middle Eastern music boomed from a stereo system rigged to the back of a truck that followed the crowd. Some of the people wept as they cried out, "Long live the resistance," in Kurdish. The march went on for about an hour, with supporters and members of many different Okmaydan militant factions attending. The disputes were on ice for now. Aganazli was a Turkish communist, but died defending Kurds in a foreign land. His death was one of true solidarity. Okmaydan recognised that. As it got dark, police riot vans began pulling up to the entrance of the neighbourhood. The occasional squawk of the sirens could be heard a few blocks away. The procession of mourners, around 200 people at this point, stopped at an intersection. The mood had changed. Everyone turned their heads. A small group of young men wearing balaclavas had filtered into the procession. They moved past me, strutting confidently through the crowd. They stepped into the centre and held up a megaphone. People smiled and whispered amongst themselves. They weren't intimidated, they were excited. "We invite the youth to go to Kobani to pay our dues and fulfil our duty of honour," said one of the masked men. "As long as the attacks continue, our lives cannot be normal. Martyrs do not die. Martyrs do not die," the crowd chanted back. Their voices echoed loudly throughout the narrow streets and graffiti-covered buildings of Okmaydan. The young men in balaclavas were members of the Istanbul cell of the YDGH. The crowd dispersed quickly after the speech. The lads in masks took off one way with around 50 others following them. I tagged along, running to the front to speak to the commander of the group. He was lean, in his 20s, and went by the alias Rizgar. He was smoking a cigarette through his balaclava and swapping phones with one of his friends. Something was clearly happening. With the help of an interpreter, I asked if we could follow them. He looked around for a minute. "Okay," he nodded, "just don't film anyone without a mask." There was some distant shouting up the road. The police trucks had entered Okmaydan. We all ran to a dark intersection where each main road seemed to connect to the next via grids of narrow alleyways and shortcuts. Rizgar told us to wait. The youth vanished, scurrying into the darkness. Younger lads began emerging from the alleyways. They couldn't have been more than 11 years old. They carried bags of rubbish with them, which they dumped across the main roads to form little barricades. They doused the bags in petrol and set them alight. They stood to the side of the road, watching the flames melt the plastic bags. For a moment, it felt like everyone in Okmaidan had fallen silent. The only sounds were those of the neighbourhood, the sporadic shriek of the sirens, the popping of burning plastic, dry brakes squeaking on a bike somewhere. Then we heard chanting slowly rising from the alleyways. The crowd of young YDGH members emerged from the darkness. They doubled. There were around 80 of them now. All had their faces covered with balaclavas, tied up t-shirts or old rags with holes cut out for the eyes. They wore gloves and some had socks pulled over their trainers. I'd later learned that they naively figured out that the police wouldn't be able to identify them this way. Most of these young men were teenagers. They all marched single file like soldiers. In unison, they threw up victory signs with their fingers and continued to chant their songs about the Kurdish resistance. Once they'd all filtered into the street, they dropped holdalls on the pavement and unzipped them. Each was filled with petrol bombs. Rizgar showed me them all lined up in the bag. I laughed because they were made using empty bottles of Efes, a cheap Turkish lager I'd been drinking all week. These Efes bottles were now filled with oil and petrol, with a damp petrol rag hanging from the top. Molotov cocktails. The youth gathered around and took a bottle each. They lit them up. Quickly, the young militants spread out through the alleyways, their shadows dancing across the walls by the light of their Molotovs. The police were close now, firing huge tear gas grenades from the turrets of their trucks. The grenades smashing into the walls. Each one was aimed at head height. White clouds of tear gas rose from the canisters. It engulfed us. I felt like my eyes were burning out of my skull. A few of the youth booted the canisters back up the road. Some seemed almost immune to the gas. Everyone began to scramble. Half blind, I ducked my head down and ran with them. I caught up and followed closely behind Rizgar as he dashed through the alleyways with a few of his friends. We ran up through the streets, leapt over a wall and sprinted across an intersection to a small alleyway. They had this area mapped out in their heads. Rizgar took a position at the edge of the alley. Him and three others jumped out into the street and pelted a police truck with their Molotovs. It was roughly 20 feet away. Rizgar's aim was perfect. His bottle smashed into one of the grills that were bolted across the truck's windscreen. Flames washed across the front of the vehicle for a moment. Rizgar moved quickly, sprinting off to a second position. This was happening all over the neighbourhood. Fireworks, Molotovs and rocks were being used to attack the police at every corner. At one point, a lad opposite us pulled a handgun from his belt and fired five rounds at the police trucks up the road. He shouted something, looked across at me and Phil, then pointed the gun at us. "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa," I shouted to him from across the road. Useless, of course. He kept the gun aimed straight. Phil lowered the camera. The gunman shouted angrily at us in Turkish as we backed away behind a parked car. Luckily, he lowered the gun and ran off down the road. It was only then that I noticed the small crowd of children gathered on the corner, probably only 10 yards from where the gunman had shot at the police. After an hour or so, Okmaidan was trashed. Piles of rubbish burned in the streets, shattered glass and petrol covered every road, and the steady response from the police left each alleyway filled with a white haze of tear gas. I sat ducked round the corner with Rizgar as he paused for a smoke. He pulled up his trouser leg to show me a swelling on his ankle. He explained that he'd been in similar clashes the week before and had been injured by a tear gas canister. "Just as the YPG continued to fight whilst wounded, we still will keep resisting," he said. He was revving himself up. A few of his friends nearby echoed the sentiment. Suddenly from each corner, the chanting of YDGH rose. They shouted each letter in their mother tongue. As the chants of his friends got louder, Rizgar sprang into action. He ran out from the corner and took cover behind an electric box. He lit up a large firework and aimed it at the police. A volley of red sparks shot from the cardboard tube and exploded all around the police trucks up the road. The police fired back. Two tear gas grenades. They smashed straight into the adjacent side of the electric box. A cloud of tear gas soon surrounded Rizgar. Coughing, he crouched down and started shaking his head. "Breathe, breathe," shouted one of his mates in the mist. Rizgar rubbed at his face through the eye holes in his balaclava. He spoke to himself briefly, then stood up amidst the tear gas. "You murderers will soon see how brave the Kurdish people are," he shouted. "As long as the PKK are in the mountains and the YPG are in Kobani, we will be on the streets fighting." Back then, the YDGH was a small group of angry Kurdish youth, throwing rocks and petrol bombs at police. Within 6 months, they'd lead a small-scale war against the Turkish government, which would leave hundreds dead and thousands imprisoned.